The second volume of The Secret Doctrine, which is entitled Anthropogenesis, deals with the birth and development of humanity. It's a long and complex story, but it also is one of its one of the things that it describes is the evolution and development of mind as far as man is concerned. And in the beautiful stanzas which describe this process, there is one wherein allegorically the various creators of man, one of them is made to say, but man needs a mind to embrace the universe. And then the dialogue follows on from there. Various creators say, well, I haven't got a mind. I couldn't give them a mind. And so it goes on from there. But it's that beauty of that particular phrase, but man needs a mind to embrace the universe, which has inspired me over the years. And this talk this evening is going to be about the nature of the mind looked at from a theosophical perspective. So I've used that title to give it the sort of scope that I want you to I want you to embrace, if you will. Mind is that far-reaching. With it we can indeed embrace, take in, absorb, understand the universe itself. Perhaps not in all its aspects, but certainly that's the scope and range of mind as far as we are concerned. Mind, when we look at it from the human perspective, is absolutely crucial. Looked at in a theosophical perspective, mind is that crucial ingredient which makes us human. Of the other kingdoms of nature which share this particular planet, this globe with us, the other six kingdoms of nature that we talk of theosophically, it is only man, the apex of those seven kingdoms of nature, who is said to possess mind. And one of our teachers has said, when speaking of this mind, that it is that which makes him the one free agent in nature. Man, whose intelligence makes him the one free agent in nature. It's a staggering responsibility. I'll talk a little bit more about those responsibilities towards the end of the talk, but it is the mind which gives us the ability to be self-conscious as opposed to just conscious in its various degrees, to be aware of our own internal, apparently subjective processes of consciousness, mind, content of mind, and so forth. It is that which gives us discrimination and choice, and with that choice comes responsibility. And it's that responsibility that we now have, whether we like it or not. We are responsible agents, and we will be made responsible for our actions from here on. Perhaps it would be just as well to understand the nature of the mind which gives us or endows us with this responsibility for ourselves, for the other kingdoms of nature with whom we share the planet, and for the very planet itself. We're all very conscious, I guess, at the moment of the ecological issues which face us, and I think you will appreciate that it is man which has largely created the ecological crisis that we all face today, and again, it's going to be we who are going to face those consequences. So again, let us try to understand a little bit about that element within us which gives us the freedom of choice, which allows us to make both the mistakes that we make and the successes that we create, and allows us to understand what it is that brings about that that responsibility. I guess to start off, what I'd like to do is to come up with something of a working definition of mind as far as the talk this evening is concerned. There's a passage which has often struck me as significant, if not puzzling, in The Secret Doctrine, where Madame Blavatsky, the author, talks about mind. Very early on in The Secret Doctrine, she says, mind is the sum of the states grouped together as thought, will, and feeling. Now, if you had thought, if your particular definition of mind only includes thinking and all sorts of mental functions like that, then the definition offered by Madame Blavatsky widens that out very considerably. Thought, will, and feeling. Let me just say a little bit about that for a moment. One of my areas of interest is computers. And there's a nice model whereby you can compare mind, the human mind, with a computer. Now, very early on I was taught when I was learning computers that a computer is capable of only three things. It can handle input from the outside world, the world external to the central processor of the computer. It can process information, and it can create output. Input, processing, and output. Well, if you think about it, the analogy given here of thought, will, and feeling very neatly corresponds to those. Feeling is our way of sensing our world. Now, I don't just mean sensing it physically through the five senses, but in any way in which we can sense the world. You will appreciate that you can sense the world emotionally. You are empathic into varying degrees. You sense the emotional atmosphere around you. You perceive that. You perceive other people's thoughts. I'm not talking about clairvoyance now, but you just know, in some way, you sense other people's thoughts without them actually enunciating them or giving expression to them. So feeling, in the very broadest sense, is the way in which we sense or perceive our world. Will, on the other hand, is the way in which we act on that world. So will, whether expressed through physical deeds or emotional deeds, because you act emotionally just as much as you act anywhere in any other way, or act mentally, when you speak, when you think, when you write, when you communicate, all of these are mental acts. You are influencing the mental world around you. Thought is, if you will, the way in which we process what goes on, what we've received by way of input from the outside world. We process that data, to use the computer model, and that creates the basis on which we then act. So thought, will, and feeling, in her terms, are those elements which go to make up the various mental states that we experience. So mind, she says, is the sum of the states grouped under thought, will, and feeling. And for the sake of this evening, I shall use those terms to give you some sort of feel for what I'm here talking about. But let's explore that word mind a little further. Mind, in our language, is a noun. And nouns we associate with things, do we not? But is mind a thing? Well, I shall argue that it is not, and that our language is very misleading in the sense that it suggests to us, by the very use of the word mind, that it is a thing which in some way we could apprehend, grasp, understand, any of these sorts of things. Whereas what I shall suggest is that mind is a process, and in the sense that it's a process, you cannot grasp it. A river is a process. Can you grasp a river? Plainly not. There is a nice little Zen dialogue, which I remember coming across some time ago, where the pupil comes to the master and says, "Master, try as I might, I cannot still my mind." And the master says to him, "Well, bring me your mind, and I will still it." And the student significantly says, "When I look for it, I cannot find it." And at which point the master then aptly says, "Well, there you are, I've stilled it for you, haven't I?" But it's that crucial phrase, "When I look for it, I cannot find it," which is, I think, the essence of this whole problem. If I ask you to look for your mind, you cannot find it. You can find mental process, you can find thoughts, you can find memories, you can find faculties, but when you try and find a thing, which we call the mind, it slips through your fingers. It's not there any longer. It's one of these, it's a non-problem, really, because it's only our language which even makes us think that there might be a thing that we could in some way discover. But I'd like you to think then in terms of mind as process, which I think is the key thing. Take another simple analogy, which again our language ties us up with. Take something as simple as seeing and sight. We have the verb to see, and hence seeing, but we also use the noun sight. You don't expect to find an object, do you? Sight. Your experience is in seeing, however we go about it. And seeing is process. It's continuously changing, isn't it? You don't see the same thing 2 seconds running. It's only, in fact, where things change that you can see at all, as biologists have, in fact, discovered. It's only where there's change in the visual field that consciousness of the objects of sight wells up at all. You can't. It's not a thing, it's a process. And it's only where it's happening in time, which is what a process, in fact, entails, that we can grasp it and understand it at all. So, mind, as soon as we start to look at it, we have to see in terms of process. So we shall be much more concerned with faculty rather than trying to identify a single thing which we can otherwise call mind. Now I'd like to look at a series of areas with which the mind is concerned and try and, from a theosophical point of view, deepen your understanding, if you will, of what is involved here. First, what I'd like to do is to look at what sphere or in what area does the mind operate. Now, before we come across theosophical or other occult views concerning the mind, mind seems to us to be something subjective, which happens somewhere in here, though where in here is, we're not quite too sure. And we contrast that with the out there of the so-called objective world with which we normally deal. But when we start examining this process from a theosophical point of view, we see that the in here turns out to be probably more important, more significant, despite the fact that it seems subjective, mere fancy, mere this, that, and the other. In fact, from a theosophical point of view, it turns out to be the more important component compared with the external world. Why? Well, we have a model in the theosophical worldview which says that the cosmos, the universe, has been formed, hesitate to use the word created, but formed, from a relatively subjective condition into a relatively objective condition that we now see. What we see in terms of the physical world, if you will, is the last stage in a process which started with the what is to us relatively subjective and has moved through a series of stages of becoming more and more objective, tangible, real, sensible to our five senses. We start with what you might call the divine, the spiritual, which is very close to the origin, the one from which the universe has emerged, and moving through a series of evolutionary stages in which the one gradually becomes the many, so we move outwardly to the world that we experience. Now, the process is an intelligent process and happens according to idea, plan, if you will. And the world that we see is the ultimate expression of what you might call the universal mind, the ideas which have formed, patterned, given structure to the world that we actually experience. So the reality of those inner worlds is of paramount importance. Now, what we would say is that the mind that we experience, or the faculties that we use, that we call mind, belong more to those inner worlds than to the outer worlds with which we deal in terms of our five senses and our bodies. What we would then go on to say is that because those are nearer the source, nearer the one from which all has emerged, they are more real than the seemingly tangible world that we call the physical world. It turns, if you will, common sense on its head, where we think normally in terms of common sense of, this is real, I know this is real, this chair that I'm sitting on is definitely real, and my subjective little thoughts, which seem to flit about in my mind from time to time, well, they can't be as real as this, can they? Well, the theosophical model turns that completely on its head and says, well, in fact, What goes on in terms of thinking and thought processes, is much more real than the material world which we experience through our senses. Despite its tangibility, the consensus reality that it creates for us and so forth, we would say that causatively, in terms of how the world was produced, the inner, which is of the nature of mind, is more real, more substantial than that which we experience as the external world. Now, where in this picture, then, does mind, in the human terms, fit? Well, in order to explain that a little, I'd like to review with you some ideas which probably are familiar to many of you concerning the nature of man. You've probably heard that from a theosophical point of view, we regard man as having a number of aspects or principles, seven in number, of which the mind of which I'm talking about this evening is one. True, and I've no intention of elaborating those seven principles in this talk this evening. What I would highlight for you in this constitution of man is that there are two poles, if you will. There are two elements, two groupings of principles within the man, which are of crucial significance if we would understand the nature and function of mind. We say that there are... We know that there is a reincarnating process that we all undergo. What we do is to contrast the personality which exists and is created specifically for or grows within one incarnation and therefore is unique to that incarnation with that which persists throughout our whole stream of incarnations. Terms which are used theosophically to describe these are that the indwelling part is what we call the individuality, and that which exists for one life only we refer to as the personality. Now, I know psychologists will use these terms differently, but we're all entitled to define our own terms the way we like, aren't we? Everyone else does, so why shouldn't theosophists? So for the sake of this discussion, then, individuality I shall use to refer to that persisting part, that which culls the experience from our personalities, and that which ultimately is going through the transformative processes of evolution. The personality exists for one life only, and is, if you will, the playground in which this process of learning takes place. It may seem very real, very important, very significant to us, but in the overall scheme of things, what we experience, learn, and develop in any one life takes on a much reduced significance. Now, within that context, within this polarity between the inner individuality, the inner man, which sometimes is referred to, the inner person, perhaps I ought to say, and the outer, the personality, we get the area within which the mind operates. Now, when we start talking about mind, haven't the time in a talk like such as the one this evening to talk about the origins of this, only about where we now find ourselves in the development of it. Mind, having evolved in us, having developed to the state that it has, creates for us the sense of I. Now, we all of us have within us that a sense of ego, if you will, I-ness. I do this, I think that, I would like this, I don't like the other. All our sentences, or a lot of our sentences, don't they, start with I, and that we identify that with this ego within us. Now, it's particularly crucial in man because we're aware of it. And when I say to you, you start a lot of your sentences with I think, I feel, I like, I dislike, whatever it is, you all immediately think, oh yeah, that's true. You've actually done a quick introspection act and thought, yeah, there is an I know what he's talking about. You're aware of it. So hence the term which we use, I am I. Yeah, you know this is so. We're aware of this. Now this sense of I am I, we say... is the direct result of having developed mind. So again, that's going to be crucial to understanding who and what we are and how we work. Now, in the theosophical model, we say that this sense of I operates, if you will, at two different levels. It operates at the level of the individuality that I just talked about, as well as that of the personality. Now, at the level of the personality, it's what this is, if what we call, we could call the personal I, the personal ego, and that is what we're all immediately and directly and daily familiar with. You can't doubt that you've got a personal ego. The question is, have we got anything else? Well, to the extent that we feel that we that there is this reincarnating process and that there is an individuality, we say that there is another sense in which we can talk about I, and we can either call it a higher ego, an inner ego, a reincarnating ego, a number of terms which are used to describe it. But again, the same quality will inhere in that ego as inheres in this one. It will know itself to be. It will be aware of itself and content and aware of its capabilities for action and so forth. So two egos. Really? No. One ego with two aspects, or operating in two different spheres, operating in two different ways. We have, again, the principle of mind, of mentation, is one within us, but it operates or functions in two different ways or two different spheres or in two different areas. In the sphere of the personal ego, operating as it must through the physical body with its brain and senses, it is limited and constrained in what it can do. It can only operate in and through the physical body, and therefore necessarily, for instance, its conceptions are based on what the five senses tell us. You know of the colours of the spectrum. If I ask you suddenly to imagine an eighth colour of the spectrum, you're a bit hard-pressed to do it, aren't you? Because you don't have a physical referent for another colour. And what you don't have a physical referent for, you do actually find it very difficult to conceive of. You can imagine that there might be an eighth and ninth and tenth colour, but if you actually are required to describe or experience internally what that other colour is, you can't, because you're limited by the faculties of your brain and senses. The inner ego, which is that reincarnating ego, which indwells in or is the essence of the individuality of which I spoke a moment ago, has the free and unshackled use of the faculties of the mind and operates mentally in a completely different sphere from that of the personal ego at all. It dwells in these inner worlds of which the outer physical world is a mere shadow or reflection. It is a reality which is outside our conception of three-dimensional space, is outside our conception of time as a sequential series of past, present, and future. That sort of ego thinks quite differently from the way in which our personal egos operate and think. There are two ways in which our mind appears to operate. I mean, I know we can divide this up into a number of ways, but one I'd like to highlight, I'll tell you why in just a minute, two ways in which we're becoming more and more conscious in this century, certainly, if not in earlier centuries. The way in which our minds appear to work, our lower personal minds appear to work, is in a highly analytical fashion. What I mean by analytical, I mean any of the work that we do which requires us to analyze, to separate, to discriminate, to look at in parts, rather than looking at in any other way. And most of the disciplines that you care to look at are concerned with analytical functions. We're concerned with analysis, cataloging, separating, distinguishing, listing. I'm sure you can think of a thousand and one in different examples. But there is another mode in which the mind can operate, And this we know of ourselves, and that is what you might call a synthetic mode, in which we synthesize rather than analyze. Now, the interesting thing about analysis is that in the process of analysis, we lose a lot. We lose a lot of truth. You can take a plant, for instance, and you can dissect it, catalogue it, and tell me, and list all the parts of the plant. You can tell me about the stem and the stamen and the petals and the sepals and whatever else, and you can lay them all out. But what have you got? A dead plant. If you would understand the living plant, you've got to understand that as a whole, not as a collection of bits. And that, when you stop to think about it, clearly demonstrates that the whole is much more than a collection of parts. If you ask a biologist to put the plant back together again, let's have a living plant again, he can't do it. Once you've actually taken it apart, in the way that you do for analysis, you've lost the wholeness, which was much more than the sum of its parts. Why? Because it existed in time. A plant isn't just the thing that you see today, but it grew from its seed through the stage that you see today, through the flowering, through the processes of decay. Again, like we were saying of mind earlier, it's a process. When you stop to think about it, a lot in cosmos is much more in the nature of process than it is in the nature of things. The analytical mind would much rather deal in things, cataloguing and separating, listing things, because it thinks it can understand things. This is the scientific reductionist approach. If you cut it up into small enough parts, surely you must come to a part that you can understand. So let's keep on cutting it up. Well, they followed that process through the physicists until they got down to elementary particles, which didn't seem to follow that model at all. We got down to, through molecules, down to atoms, and then down to subatomic particles like protons and neutrons. And then those appeared to be made of elusive particles called quarks or quarks. But they just sort of kind of trickle through your fingers when you look for them. You can't actually find them any longer. They turn to be out more like mental constructs than they do anything else. And in terms of a reductionist approach of actually getting down to bits, it's very disappointing. Again, it seems that if you're to understand the physical world, you've got to understand it far more as process than you have in terms of things. So there is a quality of the mind with which we can understand these things in quite a different mode, what I've called the synthetic mode. It's recognized in a number of fields now. You may have come across what they call the systems approach, system's mode of thinking of things, which is to understand things as dynamic processes rather than to understand them as the components which make them up. And very profitable it is too. But again, it requires a synthesis or understanding things as a whole in order to operate that way. I'd like to contrast, if you will, these two ways of operating in our minds. You may be thinking, oh, this corresponds fairly neatly to what we know as the left brain and right brain approaches. Yes, it's reflected in that, but there's something more to it than that as well. The analytical mode has got us into deep trouble, and if we're not at all careful, it's going to continue to get us into deep trouble. In analyzing and in separating our reality into bits, into separable, calculable bits, we have made a fundamental blunder. Now, it's not just me that suddenly recognized this. This has been recognized by sages and so forth for ages. There's a very ancient Chinese poem, Taoist or pre-Taoist, I guess, which just starts out this way. It says, the great way, by which it means the path, the Tao, whatever you want to call it, the great way is not difficult. It only avoids picking and choosing. Well, of course, picking and choosing is exactly what the analytical discriminative mind does. A little later on, it goes on to say, a split hair's difference and heaven and earth are set apart. Yeah, it's the mind that does it, though. It's the mind which says, this is heaven and that is earth, which has created that difference. Nature knows no such difference. Things are just as they are, as syntheses, as wholes, not as the parts which we try and pretend that they are. Now, why is this such a terrible blunder? Well, in thinking of things as separate, we apply it to ourselves, and we think, therefore, that we are separate too. I'm separate from you, we're all separate from one another, and as a result of that separateness, that argued separateness, well, if I'm separate from you, I better fight for myself, hadn't I? I better defend my rights. I better look out for myself, because no one else is going to. It creates, in creating that sense of individuality, which I spoke about earlier, we've created a double-edged sword. Yes, we've now woken up to the fact that we are individual, which is true enough. But also, we then go a little bit too far and say, yes, and separate. Yeah, I'm me and no other, and to hell with the rest of you. Now, that's where this process of analysis goes too far, and it creates the sense of separateness, which gives rise to all the sorts of vices that we as humanity are prone, selfishness key amongst them. Selfishness just means I want things for me, which when you think that I am alone and separate, seems a very reasonable thing to say. But when you realize that it is the mind, the separative, discriminative mind, which has created this problem, you realize that perhaps we've just gone a bit too far in that direction. There is, in the theosophical classic, The Voice of the Silence, a phrase oft-quoted amongst theosophists from that just says, the mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer, it goes on to say. Well, what mind is it talking about? It's talking about this analytical, discriminative mind. You slay reality as soon as you try and chop it up. As soon as you try and analyze it, as soon as you try and say this and not that. This was the great insight of the Taoist thought, which has been taken forward in other traditions as well, that the universe, the world, is just as it is. It is one integral whole. It is one integral process in which one can identify, sure, processes within processes. Just in looking at a river, you can see little eddies, little whirlpools inside it. There's a process within the broader process of the river, but nonetheless, there's still only one river, and that they are interdependent. You can't have a little whirlpool on its own. The little eddy or whirlpool or whatever it is that you see in the river can only happen in the context of the river, of a flowing river. That is the environment which creates it. The little whirlpool can't say, well, I just fancy being a separate little whirlpool. I don't need this river at all. The river is irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. I will just continue to be an eddy, a whirlpool on my own. It doesn't make any sense, because there is a greater interdependent reality of which that whirlpool is just a part. So I would argue with us. We are, and I don't want to sound derogatory, but we're just little whirlpools too. Maybe you feel yourself a bit more than a little whirlpool, but just for the sake of the analogy, we too are interdependent in the environment in which we find ourselves. And we need to acknowledge that interdependency in order not to feel ourselves separate and to act from that separateness which creates, as I said, the selfishness I mentioned earlier. I'd like to talk a little bit about mind from a slightly different point of view now. The theosophical tradition, especially rooted in the secret doctrine, says that the development of this faculty of mind makes us creators. Now, without going into how did we actually come by mind in the first place, which is a rather long story, and one which I certainly don't have time to tell this evening, much as I might like to, What it, that story ultimately says of us is that we are creators. Just as I said, the universal process was created from within outwardly, and the universe is, to go off on a slight tangent, the universe is nothing but beings, is one of the central messages of the secret doctrine. There are no empty spaces, there are no dead bits anywhere. The universe is nothing but beings. Now, one of the functions of those beings, or certain orders of those beings, is to act as creators. Now, you act as a creator every time you think or imagine or create mental pictures of one form or another. In your own limited sphere, in your own minor way, you are a creator. You are producing something out of nothing. The images that you create, the combinations that you create, the projections that you come up with, are unique. You are acting as a creator. Now, this is a fascinating aspect of what mind has endowed us with. We can talk about, and perhaps we will in just a minute, mind in terms of thoughts, mind in terms of faculties and so forth, but there is something deep within us, at whatever level our mind actually operates, which is original, spontaneous, unpredictable. And that is the real genius, if you will, of the mind, or what it is that represents mind in us. Much of the way in which we use mind is in repetitious, grooved ways where we think along the same lines and the same thoughts go through our minds again and again. But we know that we have within us, if it's there in one person, it's there in all of us, because we're all modelled and built in the same way, we all have within us the genius which allows us to create. If we see this genius in a Beethoven and a Mozart, if we see it in an Einstein, if we see it in a Plato, then you can be absolutely sure that it's there in you too. Maybe you haven't developed it, and we're not all concert pianists, although we all have the physical equipment which would allow us to be concert pianists. If this creative faculty is there within one, it's there within all of us. And I believe it's recognisably there in all of us. Let me just give you one small example of the sort of thing I'm talking about here. Consider with me for a moment the nature of choice. We all have choices to make. How do you actually make a choice? Yeah? If I ask you to make a choice, or if you think of a choice that you have made, and you then look back on it, how did you actually make that choice? Well, you may say, well, I thought about all the issues, and I weighed them all up, and I thought of the pros and cons, and I mulled them over, and I slept on it for a certain while, and then I made up my mind. Yes, but it's that last crucial sentence, and then I made up my mind, which is the one I want you to come to. At what point did you actually decide which way you were going to go, what was going to be the result, the outcome of the process that you'd actually been through? I challenge you, I don't expect you to respond at this moment, but you know, I challenge you to take this away with you. I challenge you to try and look at that moment at which you decided to choose. You see, when I use that phrase, it's nonsense, isn't it? You didn't decide to choose. You didn't choose to choose, you just chose. It was a spontaneous thing which just happened. I'm not saying it was random, I'm not saying it was out of context and so forth. No doubt you had looked at all the issues and so forth, but somehow when the decision was made, it occurred spontaneously, originally, uniquely, in whatever way it did. I mean, it may have been, you may have made it under pressure. You may have made it because other people wanted you to go this particular way, but in the last resort, you did it. And right up until that moment, you could have done something else. You can put somebody in chains, you can limit his freedom as physically, but you can never limit his freedom mentally in this particular way. If someone chooses to be a slave, that's their choice. The alternatives may have seemed unacceptable, but you had to choose to accept that particular situation. Whatever way you look at it, choice is, as I say, original, spontaneous, and unique. And that is the real genius which makes us creators in the world in which we live. It is we who, through these processes, can make a real, significant difference to the world around us. This is why, as in that passage I quoted earlier, we say that it is man whose intelligence makes him the one free agent in nature. The one agent, the one doer, whose actions you cannot double guess, you cannot predict. You can make statistical guesses and you'll probably be right most of the time. But when you get down to the individual level, you cannot be absolutely sure what way somebody's going to jump. And I don't believe that you ever will be able to predict, guess, which way that will go. There is within you what I would like to call genius. And I'm using that word advisedly. I'm not saying you are all geniuses. I'm just saying that there is genius within you, which allows you to act in this sort of way. Now, most of us, if you will, I don't mean to be rude here, most of us are lazy as far as this is concerned, and we don't exercise this genius very often. Mostly, it's more comfortable to continue doing things the way we've always done them. Habit, peer group pressure, family, culture, whatever else. All of these things make it more comfortable for us to act, to think, to do in an easy fashion, in an easy, comfortable way. But at any moment, we have that ability within us to say, nope, I'm going to do it differently. And your spontaneous, unpredictable choice can be in a different direction. That is what makes us truly unique in nature. And that quality comes from deep within us, really deep within us. And it's something which no other kingdom in nature on this particular planet has, we believe. I'd like to move on now to consider the responsibilities. I started to talk about this at the beginning, but I'd like to move on now to talk about the responsibilities that this nature of mind has developed within us, or has endowed us with. Now, I've said that that mind gives us discrimination and choice. Now, discrimination and choice is a very double-edged sword. Discrimination, as I've already tried to point out to you, in the analytical sense, can create all sorts of problems and can get us tied up in all sorts of artificial issues which aren't really real at all. Let me give you an example. Philosophers for the last two or three centuries have got caught up in a dichotomy between mind and body, which was created by a Frenchman, René Descartes, and a lot of philosophy subsequent to him takes after his name, Cartesian thought, which separates mind from body. And then, having created this problem, you then wonder how mind and body interact. And, of course, it's actually quite difficult to try and work out how mind and body interact. And all sorts of ingenious theories come about, and Descartes himself thought it was through the pineal gland that these things operated. But nonetheless, what you have done is to use the discriminative analytical function of the mind to create a problem which doesn't actually exist. There is no separation between mind and body. They're one process. All that you're doing is looking at that one process from two different angles, from two different descriptive points of view, describing two different things. So not surprisingly, you come up with two very different descriptions. I mean, if I were to describe a play of Shakespeare's in terms of the number of A's and the number of B's and the number of C's there are in the text, you come up with one sort of description. But it's a very different sort of description than you get when you get a group of actors on the stage who actually portray the thoughts and the feelings which are tied up in that play. It's the same play, but you're looking at it from two different points of view. And if you then ask, well, how does the one interact on the other? Well, it's nonsense, isn't it? It's not a problem. You've created a problem where none exists. So with this Cartesian philosophy, you've created a problem where none exists. You've just described one process from two different points of view. So it's this which gives us discrimination But we need to be careful that we don't overuse this power of analytical thought. So discrimination, then, is vital to us because we have this ability to choose, as I've just been trying to talk about, because we are capable of this unique, spontaneous action, we are also responsible for the outcomes of what happens there. If you have no choice in the matter, nobody can hold you responsible, can they, for what happens? I mean, nobody blames a snooker ball or a billiard ball, you know, for bouncing into another ball and causing it to roll off in a different direction. You don't blame it because, you know, there was no choice in the matter. It was merely obeying the laws of nature, the physical laws of nature. There was no choice. There was no other way it could have behaved. Therefore, no blame, no responsibility accrues to the first ball in hitting the second. But with you, it's quite different. Because you can choose, because you could have acted one way and you chose to act a different way, nature holds you responsible for all that ensues from the result of that action. And this is what, of course, we know as karma. You have disturbed the universe in a certain way, and therefore the effects now ripple out from that point of departure, your original, spontaneous, unique action. And the universe will look to you to redress the balance, to set the balance right again. It's like when you drop something into a pool of water and you watch the ripples spread out to the banks, bounce off the bank and reconverge on the point where the drop of water entered the water. Again, it comes back to the point of action, looking for redress. It is central to this whole worldview, this theosophical worldview, that we are held responsible for our actions in this particular way. But, of course, we are acting on a number of different levels at the same time, if we wish to look at this in an analytical way. I do something physically, but standing behind this are my thoughts and feelings, which led to that particular action. Now, which we would then ask are the more productive causes? Well, bearing in mind that what I was saying earlier about our model of the universe, which says it's the inner which is the more important, the more productive of effects, the outer being the shadow, the reflection, this final sphere when things come to a conclusion. Excuse me. We would have to say that our thoughts and feelings about the matter, what you might call our inner motivation for our physical action, is far more productive of effects than the physical acts, which are the last link in the chain. Therefore, it is said, and for these reasons, that karma judges motive as much as, if not more than, the physical action that we perform. It is that mind, again, which has given us this ability to choose and to discriminate, which has therefore given us the right to be judged, if you will. Not judged by anybody, but judged by nature as a whole, as a result of the actions that we make. To the extent that our actions are in tune with nature and her processes, we are treated as co-creators with nature, and we work with her. To the extent that our actions run counter to the general direction in which nature as a whole is moving, so we may expect nature to bite us, if you will, and come back and say, "Oi, this was counterproductive. And if you continue to do this, you may expect this sort of result to happen again and again." And being human, of course, we don't listen. And so, of course, it does happen again and again. I remember seeing a little cartoon, which I think sort of thought some of that up rather neatly. It just said, had two people talking to one another, and one was saying, "I wonder if the reason why history repeats itself is that we don't listen in the first place." Hmm. following on from this idea is the responsibility which accrues from this. Because we are mental creators, much responsibility accrues. Now, you may think, mental creators? Well, there's a phrase which sums this up, which is, ideas rule the world. And you may think that that's a rather grandiose statement, but when you stop to think about it, it is absolutely and literally true. If you look at human organization, human society, and so forth, it is ruled almost entirely by idea rather than anything else. Let me give you a small example of this. Take an institution, a college, a hospital, something of that nature. What actually makes up that institution? Well, let's take as an example a university, a college. Is it the place where the college is located? Is it the bricks and mortar which makes it up? Well, plainly not, because if you wanted to, you could move it. Is it the physical location? No, plainly not, because, you know, colleges do, from time to time, move location, and it's still recognizably the same college when you get there. Is it the lecturers who give their courses there? Well, plainly not, because they change over time. And it's still, the University of Chicago or wherever, 10 years down the track, where most of the staff have moved on or changed. So it's plainly not them. Is it the students? Well, no, they're even more transient. They stay for their 3 or 4 year course and then they're gone, but another lot comes in. So the University of Chicago is not its students either, is it? It's not the place, it's not the building, it's not the people. So what is it? What is it that makes us persist in this way? And when you go to a college, you behave in a really quite recognizable pattern, don't you? If you're a student, you know what you're supposed to do, you know which courses you're supposed to go to, you know how you're supposed to deal with and react to your professors and other teachers, you know how you're supposed to react with your fellow students. The whole set of conventions and patterns of behavior which you adopt as soon as you go there. Where's all this come from? Why do we do all these things? Nobody tells you to do those things. Nobody compels you to do all those things. It's the power of idea. There is an idea abroad that there is such a thing as the University or whatever it is of Chicago. And it is we who give that myth substance. It only lives because it lives in and through us who participate in it, who go there, who are educated there, who give lectures there, who know about it. I mean, if you've never been to the University of Chicago, I'm assuming there is a University of Chicago. Probably isn't, for all I know. It's only because we as audience know that it's there that we continue to give it credibility. If there were nobody who I knew about it, it would cease to exist. It's not a group of buildings or anything like that. It's only you and I and a lot of other people who give it any existence at all. And it's you and I who give it existence because of the way that's how we think about it. That's the power of ideas. And you can think of that, you can translate that into just about any institution that you care to name. And frequently when you find an institution which has got problems, you come down to it and you think, well, where are the problems? Yeah, where are these insuperable problems? It's only in terms of people. And if you could actually get the 10 key people and pick them up by the lapels and shake them and say, do you really mean this? They'd probably think, well, no, it didn't actually. No, it wasn't quite what we meant at all. And you'd probably find the whole thing's a total misunderstanding and that nobody really had this idea which has seemingly created the problem at all. Do you see what I mean? It's the power of ideas. Ideas do indeed rule the world, and it is you and I who have created them. It's society is only the way it is today because we all acquiesce to it. If we didn't acquiesce to it, if we didn't agree to the social institutions, the laws, and everything else, there's nothing which can make it so. The Constitution with its amendments and so forth is only the way it is, not because it's written on a piece of paper or whatever it is. It's because you all agree to it. And you with your thoughts, you with your choices, you with your discrimination, which make it so, not any other way. Ideas rule the world. It's a tremendous responsibility. And to the extent that we abrogate this responsibility and say, oh, it doesn't matter what I think, you are falling into the most fatal trap that we can all fall into. I mean, if we all think, oh, it doesn't matter what I think, then that's another pattern that we're creating, isn't it? We're creating a sort of victim mentality in which, of course, we'll accept what 10 people say and 1 million people will do it. But this is ludicrous, isn't it? When you actually think of some terror regime like the Third Reich, for instance, how many people actually had that idea that this is the way it was going to go? 100? 200? Who knows? And yet they subjugated millions, tens of millions, who were subject to the power of that idea. Ideas indeed rule the world, but think of the responsibility of actually holding forth those, or propagating those sorts of ideas, which are translated into that sort of impact on social organization. Staggering indeed it is. A final thought which I'll... sorry, I've slightly overrun, but a final thought that I'll leave you with, because I think it touches very strongly on this question of responsibility which mind endows us with, is a statement made again by one of our teachers which says that the real evil lies in man whose intelligence makes him the one free agent in nature. That's the full quote which I've used earlier. The real evil lies in man whose intelligence makes him the one free agent in nature. Why? This is a sentence which is saying that there is no external evil anywhere. It is you and I which create it. Good and evil are human creations. And creations of that discriminative mind, that power of choice which we uniquely have as far as our planet is concerned. So in terms of responsibility, it's vital that we should understand individually that the power, the genuine power that we really have. We are creators. We have created the world that we inhabited in terms of the mental institutions, the mental constructs that we choose to regard as society. It's we who are responsible for the planet as a whole. And coming back to that point that I raised right in the introduction about the ecological issues and so forth, you hear all the doom and gloom from the ecologists about how the planet is going to rapidly become uninhabitable in a short while. Who made it so? We did. And what is it within us which allowed us this to happen? When left to its own devices, I don't believe that the animal kingdoms would have ever brought the planet to this ecological crisis that we now see today. The processes of natural selection and whatever else, survival of the fittest, would have weeded out anybody who tried to create an imbalance. But man, whose intelligence has created him as this powerful force, has created all these problems. Every one of those problems that now threaten our globe are man-created problems. Overpopulation, destruction of the rainforests, any of the others that you care to name, the destruction of the ozone layer, global warming, acid rain, the list goes on endlessly. But it's we who have created every one of those. And it's this key quality, this key attribute of ours, mind, with its key characteristic of choice, unique, genuine choice, which is at the heart of that. And I guess my message here is, like I said earlier, we will be held responsible for those choices, each and every one of them. So the more we understand of the nature of this unique principle within us, which creates us as the gods, remember Genesis, if you will, lo, he has become as one of us. Indeed he had. As a result of eating of the tree of the fruit of good and evil, he had indeed become one of the gods. But, of course, the responsibilities go with that as well. So, with that thought, I will finish. Thank you. The question is concerned with the duality of mind and brain. The questioner asks whether what I said in the talk about the oneness of mind and brain can be so, seeing as after death mind continues without brain. Well, I guess my remarks were addressed to us as we exist today, physically incarnate, and in terms of the personal ego that I was addressing, certainly it is heavily dependent on the brain. The model that I like to use for that is that in developing a new personality for a new incarnation, we grow a new personality. And what we develop is physical, it is etheric, if you will, it is emotional, it is mental, it has a number of facets. It is one thing, one process, if you will, the personality, but it is something that we grow with a number of elements mixed into it. Mind is one of them, brain is certainly another. That is one thing, and that persists for the duration of that particular life or incarnation. What happens to us afterlife, when we die, I believe is entering a different phase of being altogether, in which different rules, different laws, different processes pertain. And it is not we who, so to speak, will go on to after-death states any more than it is we who will go on to reincarnate in another life. The people that we feel ourselves to be are unique to this particular phase of our existence. What happens to us after death is different again. Just to repeat the question, have we access to the higher qualities of mind that I referred to in the lecture, the level of the higher ego and the individuality, and even beyond that to the race mind? Yes, I believe we do. It's difficult for us to access that because we don't have the conceptual model which would allow us to really believe that it is so. There are two things, I think, which stop us in this respect. One of which is unbelief. To the extent that we don't believe that it's possible, we shut ourselves out from the very possibility of accessing that level of being within us. Our unbelief creates, if you will, a shell round us, quite literally a shell round us, which limits what is to us believable, and therefore we have created a limitation which doesn't actually exist in nature. Now, I think we can learn to sidestep those sorts of limitations, and in so doing, access these higher levels of being, mind, knowledge, wisdom, memory, and so forth. And I think we have enough examples of people through what we now call altered states of consciousness to give us indications of how that can be accessed. But for the most part, it's not under our active control as ordinary mortals. I believe that there will come a time in our evolution when we will be able to access that knowingly and in consciousness. But for the moment, for most of us, it happens more by way of accident than by design. Yes, I believe there is indeed such a thing as a race mind. It's an intriguing idea to speculate about as to what extent our minds act truly separately. I remember reading a science fiction novel some years ago in which the author speculated in relation to some extraterrestrial intelligence that if you had a group of intelligences, all who freely communicated information to one another, so that all that any one entity knew was instantaneously known by all other entities of that particular group, whether it was meaningful to talk about separate individuals or one collective individual. Yeah? Imagine if this were to happen with us. Supposing that I were to know, and you reciprocally, everything that was going through my mind at any particular time. For a kickoff, I wouldn't have had to sit here for the last hour laboriously trying to, and very inefficiently trying to communicate through words and ideas what I wanted to get across. You would have known it just like that. Now, if I knew what you were thinking and you knew what I was thinking and spread that round the room, to what extent are you going to feel individual any longer? Yeah? The sense of individuality is going to weaken and gradually fade away the more that begins to happen. It's just exactly because we find ourselves in a state of consciousness where I do feel totally separate from you, and I don't know what you're thinking and feeling for the most part, that allows me to think of myself as truly separate and truly individual. To the extent that that ceases to apply, despite our physical separateness, in terms of what we feel ourselves to be, we're going to increasingly feel ourselves to be one. And when we talk of race-mind, I believe that that's exactly what we would get to over time. I believe that's in part where we're going. We will get to a point, if you will, where there will be global consciousness. There's a fascinating example of this. You'll appreciate that I like science fiction. There was a series of books by Isaac Asimov which explored this particular theme. He wrote some time ago three books, the Foundation series, which I expect some of you have come across. More recently, he's updated those and added two or three more to it. And in one of those books, we come across a civilization of a particular planet where all the beings on the planet share a unit consciousness. Not only the humans, but all the other life forms on the planet shared in one gestalt consciousness. It's a fascinating idea, and I believe it is foreshadows our human evolution. I believe we are set along those lines. It may take us a long time to get there, but I believe that's exactly the place where we will get to, just exactly because as we develop more the faculties of the mind, this sharing of content, sharing of knowledge and wisdom and insight and so forth will become so prevalent, so widespread, so thorough, that it will be very difficult to distinguish whose thought it was. If a thought arises in your mind in this context, how do you know whether it was yours or somebody else's? It becomes very difficult after a while, doesn't it? So, yes, I believe that sort of group mind and global mind is a real possibility for us. I think we can touch it from time to time, even now, but I think we will develop far more fully in that direction later. Yeah. A questioner asks about my dealings with computers, seeing as I've used the computer analogy in the talk. To answer your question, I spent 20 years in the computer industry, partly as a development programmer and partly as an instructor and so forth. So I've lived with computers for 20-odd years, so I guess it's quite natural for me to want to use computers as models for these sorts of talks. I don't plan to do any more work with computers, to answer your question. My life now is going to be far more concerned with doing this sort of thing, writing and talking about theosophy, than it is to do with computers any longer. But nonetheless, it's been a useful model to follow through. But I know its limitations as a model, and I don't think that I'm going to fall into those sorts of traps. Let me give you an example. One of the key areas which is being pursued in computer science at the moment is that of artificial intelligence. Expert systems are derived from this concept of artificial intelligence, which finally boils down to the question, can you ever devise a machine which thinks? And now, of course, if you start from a reductionist approach, a mechanist approach, and you think that mind and brain are synonymous, then, of course, you would argue that if the brain is a mechanism and it produces what we know as consciousness and thought, then is there any reason why, if the computer gets sufficiently complex, that too shouldn't result in thought and indeed consciousness within the computer. But turning from a theosophical point of view, I would have to stand that on its head, that argument, and say it's all the wrong way around. But it's the... It is, to use the title of one of our theosophical books, intelligence came first. It's not the product of the form, but the form is the resultant of the intelligence. So the brain, not instantaneously, but over its evolutionary period, is the result of inner process, which contains the intelligence on which the brain has been modelled and designed, just as indeed have computers. I mean, how did computers come to be the way they are? Because we designed them, made them act that way. And we haven't yet come across heuristic computers which are capable of designing themselves spontaneously producing the next generation of computers, much as IBM might think that that was a very good idea. It would save a lot of human effort, wouldn't it? I don't believe that's ever going to happen, because I think it's intelligence which is the required dimension to create all of these things. I don't see that coming from the bottom upward. I think that's a top-down thing, or a within-out thing, which is required. So that originality, that what I've called the genius within us, is the thing which is and must ever remain missing as far as artificial intelligence is concerned. However clever it gets, and boy, it will get clever, that doesn't mean that it's thinking. The questioner is asking about how do I think the inequalities that I've mentioned can be developed and liberated, if you will. Yeah? You also mentioned the fact that I haven't used the term intuition. Deliberately not. There has developed, if you will, a theosophical jargon over years. And it's easy to slip into a jargon, and just because I use a term, you thereby think, oh yes, I know what he's talking about. Whereas it can be very misleading when we do that. So I try not to use terms which I think have got jargon connotations for the audience. In fact, I have been talking about an intuitional approach, because that synthetic mind that I was talking about, I think, has a lot of those qualities about it. But again, the levels at which that works would need to be explored to explain that. Just as that faculty, that principle, buddhi, that you mentioned, is one of the seven principles in the human constitution, so we are taught each of the principles has its own sevenfold constitution. So not only is there a buddhi as a principle in its own right, but there are buddhic aspects to a number of other principles. And if you explore that thought, it's interesting to see the way those well up. A buddhic aspect to an emotional principle. Yeah, there are. The ways in which we empathically understand, compassionately understand and so forth, other people through the feelings, but in a synthetic way, without having to understand the individual emotional elements. You don't have to analyze, you don't have to separate out. But nonetheless, there is a way of empathically understanding and feeling with, if you will, others in that way. Again, it would take longer than I've got to explore that completely. But I believe that this synthetic approach that I've been talking about is implicitly present in a lot of the ways in which we function. It's not just something extraordinary and out there and different, which we've got to aspire to and to acquire. I believe that synthetic quality, that holistic quality, wells up, if you will, within us in a number of different ways, depending on the aspect of our being that we're developing and working with. It's a question of, I guess, looking for and being open to that holistic mode in whatever level of being that we operate in. For instance, I can see that operating in the physical level. An analogy which I've found particularly helpful came from a book called The Inner Game of Tennis, which some of you may have come across. It was a book which was concerned with an alternative way of tennis coaching. It was based on minimal coaching. It was based on the insight that people learn physical skills like tennis best when just demonstrated rather than told. If you get an instructor to demonstrate how to perform a backhand, don't say a word. Just stand in front of the pupil and do it, and say, "Now you do it." They will do it far better than if actually told. "Well, now I want you to stand with your feet 9 inches apart, with your knees slightly bent, and as the ball comes to play, I want you to raise your back, your racket head above the level of the ball, and I want you to bring it down through the ball, all of this sort of stuff." And he freezes, when the ball comes towards him, he hasn't the faintest idea what to do next, because his analytical mind is trying to work far too hard, trying to understand it. But there is something synthetic, even in body skills, which allows you to do those things. You can call it instinct, you can call it what you like, but it is a holistic approach. Rather than breaking up the organic whole into bits and trying to work out what each muscle group, what each limb should be doing, and while you're trying to work out strategy and so forth, the body is quite capable of doing it all by itself. It doesn't need anybody's help. There is an intuitive, if you will, what I would call a synthetic, a holistic knowledge approach within even the body. Now, I think this applies throughout our constitution. Whatever level, whatever aspect of our nature we care to look at has this aspect to it, this synthetic aspect to it. Rather than trying to reach from the personal to the individual, if you will, from the personal ego to the higher ego, I think this strategy is much more concerned with focusing on those aspects of our behavior and dealings here and now which are concerned with the holistic than trying to develop something else. As soon as we try and develop something else, it becomes something outside us, a goal to be aspired towards, something extra to acquire, to achieve, to do, whereas what I'm looking at here is much more of an approach rather than a goal. And as I say, to look to the holistic in all your dealings, I think is the way forward, the way, if you will, to make the steps toward what you're actually asking about.